I think there was a few other questions that, yeah.
How or where do we learn what the proper image of a Buddha is if we want to try and use that?
Yeah, I mean, usually then people give instruction on that, but often what is recommended or can be recommended is if we're not so familiar with the mental image, we can use the physical image as the object initially to become familiar with it. And that's often a general recommendation, is to move to more subtle objects. Is sometimes in the text it talks about people who are very agitated, then for them maybe it's good to start with a visual object. So they often in text say something like, pick a stick or a pebble, put it in front of you and just look at it. And then after some time when the mind really settles down, then instead of the visual object, then a mental image of that object. So I think here also, particularly for people who are not so familiar with the image of a Buddha, is you can start with a visual, a picture, and use that, and then you could even sort of use that, and then halfway through, then just instead of looking at the image, imagine the image, and then you could maybe move backwards and forwards a little bit to become more and more familiar with it, and then the mental image. But again, you'll find that the getting all the details, of course, very clear, that's going to take more and more time. So again, when we have the mental image initially, is just to have some sort of image there that we're holding on, focusing on. Because if we get worried about it being super clear, then our mind just gets agitated. So the clarity will come over time. In general, of course, the qualities we're working on, which is coming up in the next section, is the stability and clarity. So the first point is just to stabilize the mind, really. Well, first, of course, relaxation is the foundation. But then to stabilize the mind so we not get distracted. Then we can work on in clarity, improving the clarity of our attention. So this often comes then later.
I'm struggling a little bit with the eyes open thing. Mm-hmm. Finding it very agitating, and I'm not certain if it's sort of like, do I stick with that and like try to get over that hump, or am I kind of...
Of course, the eyes open here often is not ideal conditions, because there's probably a lot of things in front of you, maybe people moving, and so it's easier to get sort of caught up in it. So again, as I mentioned before, we can, when we go home, is sort of optimize the conditions in terms of lighting, nothing to pull the attention, and so forth. So yeah, when I started to use the eyes open, I found it also quite sort of disconcerting but quite quickly I sort of got used to it. So certainly if you're using this practice of observing the mind, it's very much recommended to try and get used to it. If you're using the breath practice, then I think as a beginner, if our mind is so really agitated and distracted, then and that's a dominant problem, then maybe having the eyes lightly closed for some time and work with that, and then you can later experiment with having them at least a little bit open. Yes. So with every practice, for it to progress, there's two parts. There's meditation, sitting, and then what you do the rest of the day. So, of course, as we're going to see now, next, the main tool we're using in this practice is mindfulness, together with this introspection or vigilance. So here in the meditation, then we are trying to strengthen mindfulness, meaning just hold that object better and better. Sort of strengthening the muscle of mindfulness. That's why if we keep the same object, it's a familiar object, it's easier then to strengthen mindfulness. If we keep swapping the object, it's not as effective. So then that's what we do in meditation. And then in daily life, of course, we need to continue to work on the muscle of mindfulness, meaning we need to be working on being present in all of our daily life activities. And so one of those things can be to do things like walking meditation, where we're mindfully being aware of the sensations of walking and so forth. Any sort of mindful activity like this will help with this practice, absolutely.
I find walking meditation really difficult because my ankles pop and then I become agitated. And then I try to walk so they make no noise. But it just goes down.
Yeah. Again, I think with all of these sorts of practices, and in meditation in general, we don't want to be too tight. You know, often when these sorts of practices are explained, people get really tight about it. And then they get upset when things are not going according to plan. So I think this is not going to help in that or in meditation. So then I think we can do that in whatever way works best for us. I mean, some traditions, when they talk about walking meditation, even in the beginning phase, say, well, just sort of walk fairly normal, you know. Not running, but, you know, you can start. In fact, some ones I've come into contact, some of them, you know, when we do walking meditation, start by walking reasonably quick and just noticing a few different aspects of the walking. Then slowly slow down a little bit and become more aware of the individual aspects of the walking. So again, we can do at whatever level sort of is working for us.
I have one question about the objects.
Sure.
The constituents and the sources, were they things we already covered and I just can't remember?
No. And remember, this list of objects is a list of objects in general for all sorts of meditation. But the constituents and sources, you know, the aggregates is one way of dividing up not only the person but all functional phenomena. You know, that the first aggregate, the form aggregate, is all the physical phenomena and the other four are mental phenomena. Another way of dividing up all functional phenomena is into these constituents and sources. And the reason, the way of dividing this up is in terms of experiencing our experiences. That within an experience, then we have the objects of experience, we have then the sense faculties which contact those objects, and then coming out of that, we have the six types of consciousness experiences of them. So that list of 18, the six objects, the six sense faculties, and the six consciousnesses are the constituents. Whereas the sources are simply the six objects and the six sense faculties, which then lead to those experiences. So it's just a different way of dividing up things.
And the other part of the separate is basically any image of the Buddha that resonates with us.
Yeah, I mean, of course, if we are in a particular tradition and we are anticipating later we're going to move into a particular type of practice, tantric practice, then it may be useful to pick something sort of conducive with that in terms of images.
What is, because I like the Laughing Buddha, but like, what, well, that's probably not what tantric goes for.
I mean, again, the one of the advantages with visualizing a Buddha is that it hopefully inspires us as a virtuous object. So then we can use that in that way. So I think then to use an image that has that effect is fine. Okay. And then I also mentioned a third object that we can use. So we've talked a bit about the breath, the mind. And the third one that I mentioned on the first day was actually no object. Or sometimes it's called awareness of awareness. And that's what I've been introducing a little bit in some of our meditations. And that's the one we mainly did this morning after breakfast. And so this is also a shamatha practice, of course. And the difference between this and observing the mind is that in observing the mind, there is really this sense of being the observer or the witness, observing the mind and all the mental events. So experientially, it's a very sort of dualistic experience. Whereas arresting in awareness or the awareness of awareness practice, experientially, there's not really a strong sense of being this observer or witness. There is simply resting in awareness itself. So experientially, it's a much more of a non-dualistic experience. And it's much more about not really doing anything, but just being, just resting in the mind itself. And that's one of the reasons that people find this very difficult, because we always want to do something, you know. What am I looking at? What am I observing? And then so when it said resting in awareness, but then people go, well, where is this awareness thing that I'm supposed to be resting in? So it's not something we're adding. It's what's there. It's what's left over when we take everything else away. If we take away all the appearances, it's what's left. So it's not something we have to search for. We just have to come to identify what's there, that awareness, because it's the awareness which allows things to appear. So again, in this practice, it's not so much of doing anything. It's a matter of just simply resting in the awareness itself. And in this practice as well, we're not interested in appearances. So, of course, we're not trying to block appearances, but we're not observing appearances. Like in the mind practice, if a thought arises, we observe it as it arises and as it passes. In this practice, of course, these things will still appear, but we're not interested in it. So we're not paying particular attention to them. Of course, we're not trying to block them either. We're just resting in awareness itself. And this also is a practice, I think, that can bring a lot of benefit in our modern society, because we are often just so much caught up in appearances that when we grasp onto appearances also, our mind seems very small and contracted. Whereas if we rest in awareness, it's very spacious, it's very open. And also, therefore, by doing this practice, then in our daily life, even if there are a lot of things going on, we can still be in that space and not get caught up in all that stuff. So this also can be very helpful in daily life in that way. But also, because we're simply resting in awareness itself, we are coming to really see the qualities and nature of the mind. So it's a very good bridge into the Vipassana practice, coming to realize the nature of the mind. So therefore, often this is emphasized in traditions where the Vipassana practice is about investigating the nature of the mind. So this also can be a very helpful shamatha practice. Any questions about that before we move on? Yeah.
So when you introduced that, what happened with me is I became more aware of my senses input, like sounds and temperature and feelings. They were kind of on an equal par thoughts. Is that right?
Well, right. I mean, it's probably an indication that you're not selectively focusing on something. Because when we're looking at the mind, we're selectively focusing on thoughts and emotions, and then we're probably not going to notice so much the other appearances. But now in this one, we haven't got selective focus, which means that probably maybe equally or more or less equally, we're going to notice different appearances. But again, in this practice, is we're not really interested. We don't really pay attention to any appearances. So of course they will appear, but you know, just let them be there. Don't worry about them, and just focus or rest in that awareness itself, the space where the appearances arise.
Less inwardly focused, I guess.
Well, see, the thing is, with this practice, it's not really dualistic so much. So there's no sort of inward and outward. When we get really into it, there's no inward or outward. Yeah.
So to go kind of dovetail on that part. So the second, the
awareness
of the mind, as things arise and pass, that includes like sense objects,
no,
like sound.
No,
and,
you know. No. So there is a practice sometimes called in English choiceless awareness or open awareness, or where you simply be present with whatever's appearing. Good. Very good. Particularly in daily life to do this. In shamatha practice, it's much more effective to have a more specific focus in terms of developing these qualities. So therefore, in the second practice, we are only looking at mental events, thoughts, emotions, memories, mental images. And if sense objects appear, again, we're not really paying attention to them. But often what happens, of course, when a sense object appears, like there's a sound, then the mind will go, oh, bird, that's a bird. So that thought, that's a bird, is part of the object. But the actual sound, we're not really paying attention to. So in this practice, we are narrowing down to just mental objects. But of course, it's a valid practice to simply have this being present with everything that's appearing. And this can be very useful in daily life to notice what's in front of us at the sensory and at the mental level. But in terms of shamatha practice, it's usually more effective to narrow down the focus, to be more specific in terms of developing the quality of mindfulness more effectively. Yeah. So I'll go back to the breath first, is with the breath practice, then I introduced, I think, in one of the meditations, the option of counting the breaths. Because often where our mind is super conceptual, discursive, so we're trying to focus on the breath and we just get caught up in all this stuff. Whereas one little tool that can be useful as a beginner is to stop that, is to occupy the mind with some conceptual activity that's related to the practice, and that is to mentally count the breath. So at least if we're occupying our mind with that, it's harder for us to get caught up in this stuff. So some people find as a beginner that mental activity of noting or counting the breath, and in some traditions instead of counting they use noting, like mentally noting, breathing in, breathing out, and so forth. This can be a way of helping to stabilize the mind. But remember, it is conceptual activity, so it's like training wheels, meaning that if we find it useful in the initial phase to avoid distraction, use it. If you don't find it useful, don't use it. But eventually, as the mind improves, we'll need to let it go and not use it, because it is conceptual activity, but it could be useful conceptual activity as a beginner. Likewise, when we're looking at the mind, we tend to identify, get carried away. One, again, tool as a beginner that's helpful to stop grabbing onto these appearances is to give them a label. Because if you give something a name or a label, you have to see it as an object, and it gives us some breathing space. So if you find it helpful that when the mental event arises, you give it a name. Mentally, you go thought, memory, irritation, craving. If that helps to avoid getting caught up in it, use it. If it doesn't, leave it out. What we need to be careful, of course, is not to turn that into commentary. You know, something comes up. Ooh, where did that come from? Why is that there? I didn't want that to be there. Then we're just caught up.
Yeah. Say you hear the sound of a bird, you say it's a bird, that's a thought, you label it a thought, you move on. But the very words it's a bird are, you can think it's a bird without using the words it's a bird in your head, right?
Yeah.
And you can have an emotion without describing the emotion.
Exactly.
Telling it to describing it to someone else to explain what the emotion was. And
exactly.
That's where I get caught up in the
writing
a narrative.
Yeah, I mean, ideally we don't want to write a narrative at all here, but a very short one-word narrative like bird, you know, mentally that's bird, or thought, rather, that can be helpful to avoid getting caught up in heavy narratives. So we need to be careful here if we use a narrative in terms of just a name or a label, that we don't go more, because that's our normal habit. Something then we get caught up in a story. So therefore, only use this very sort of sparingly. And one of the differences, this is another point I think that's important. Often, how do we know whether we're watching thoughts arise and pass or actually following them? Sometimes it's not easy. One way to tell is what is appearing, is there some thread? Is there some connection between them? If there is, there's grasping, usually. Because often, if there's no grasping, what is appearing is very disjointed, disconnected, no connection at all. And there's a big difference between mindfully thinking and being mindful of thoughts. This is not mindfully thinking. This is being mindful of thoughts. And the difference is, for example, if a thought arises about a car, your car, then mindfully thinking is to mindfully attend to the car. Being mindful of thoughts here, the object is not the car, the object is the thought. So when we're mindfully thinking, the object is whatever the thought is about. The object is the car. Here, the object is not the car, the object is the thought about the car. So we are looking at the thought, not what the thought is about. So grasping happens when we jump into the object of the thought and we get caught up in that.
So it seems that, I mean, if your thoughts are threading together...
That's why if we...
That's us trying to put order on what otherwise would be totally chaotic, right?
Our minds are chaotic.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, if a thought of a car comes up, generally our focus is on car. Whereas if we have to give it a name, thought, then we're seeing the thought and not the car. Because once we get caught up in the car, we're gone. Whereas if the thought of car comes up and then we go thought, then we're looking at the thought, or better chance that we can see it as a thought and not as the car.
I just realized I've been doing choiceless awareness versus the thought.
Okay.
And then now I foresee myself perhaps being like, the object and not the thought. So any tips on relaxing within that of sticking to the...
Yeah, I mean, again, we can... relaxation is the basis. And so, again, with all of these practices, we have to have this balance between being... And I think this comes up here in the text very shortly... Being too tight or too relaxed. And actually, maybe we can go to that point. There is a point there. Right at the bottom of 35, where it says eliminating flawed methods, it says, if you use an intense cognition that is too tight, you may have clarity, but excitement will predominate so that it will be hard to develop stability. If you sustain your meditation after becoming greatly relaxed, you may have stability, but laxity will predominate, so you will have no vivid intensity. It is very hard to find the right balance of tension so as to be neither too taut nor too relaxed. And for this reason, it is hard to develop a concentration free from laxity and excitement. So, I mean, this is the real challenge. And the analogy often given here in the text is the guitar string. If it's too tight, it doesn't play well. If it's too loose, it doesn't play well. You have to tune it. Likewise, we have to tune our mind. If our mind is too tight, we'll get agitated and distracted. If it's too loose, we get really dull. So we need to, and this is the ongoing thing that we're trying to do, as we're going to see in this chart soon, is that we need to try and find this balance between too tight and too loose. And we can only find that balance through experience. We just have to keep fine-tuning our mind. That's the reality. I mean, even in the texts, you know, sometimes you'll see some great master saying, you know, if my mind is too tight, excitement will arise. If it's too loose, I'll get dull. What am I to do with my agitated mind? You know, it's not easy, but this is what we need to do. This is why we have mindfulness and introspection. Mindfulness is holding the object, and then introspection or vigilance is quality control. So that's the job of introspection or vigilance, is to notice if we're getting a little bit agitated and distracted, then relax. If we're getting a bit dull, sharpen, you know, the focus.
So I was putting thoughts in the categories of like past and future. Is that analyzing the thought too much? Like a memory's past and this and that's kind of
No, I mean, we can know from our own experience whether that then leads to commentary or not. So, I mean, again, with counting and noting the breath and noting the mental events is don't overdo it. You know, don't be too elaborate. But it's good, actually, to try to clearly distinguish the mental event. Because if we have to be very clear about what it is, then that forces us to be more clear and probably less likely to be caught up. You know, if someone says, just notice mental events, and then someone says, identify the mental events, I think when we try to identify the mental events, there'll be less chance of getting caught up because we want to see what it is, not just that there's something coming up. So this can also be helpful. So in the meditation, of course, we're not doing this. Right. You know, we're not saying, oh, that's the fifth of these that we've had today. but, yes, I mean, this is another advantage. See, all this stuff is going on in our mind now, but we're distracted. And so our dysfunctional mind, our pattern of how our mind is functioning, is often is not that obvious to us. It's obvious to everyone else around us. But to us, often we're blind to that. And it's only when we start to do this practice, we go, and then after the meditation, we go, wow, I really have a lot of these thoughts of jealousy. I never really realized that. So this practice also helps us in that way to really see how our mind is functioning, or rather how it is dysfunctional often. So this can be also helpful for other practices, yes.
When you introduced this, I sort of came up with categories on the fly. It was like, oh, well, you know, that's a past or, you know, thought or whatever. But it seems like there could be a lot of power to that practice. If you actually, what categories you decide you want to place your thoughts into, you know, just the very act of deciding what the categories are could be very powerful. So I wonder if there's any advice on thinking about that in advance, like during my practice today, these will be my categories.
Yes, it could be. I mean, you know, the past, present, future, that could be useful because then we can probably see that actually probably 99% of the things that are coming up is about the past and the future. Oh, actually, I'm not really in the present very often, am I? I'm just living in the past and hoping for the future. And so that can be quite insightful. Yeah, that could be useful. Attention Revolution. Okay, let's move on in the text now. So we were... the objects... Okay, so we're down the bottom of page 35. How to focus your mind on the object of meditation. The concentration that you will accomplish here has two special features: vivid intensity, an intense mental clarity, so this is the clarity, and non-discursive stability, so staying one-pointedly on the object of meditation. So here again, the two qualities we're trying to develop is stability and clarity. What, of course, is stopping stability is distraction. But often here in these sorts of texts, they don't really use the word distraction, but often excitement. Because excitement is the most common form of distraction. You know, we get distracted by the so-called sensory pleasures. And then clarity, what is stopping clarity is dullness. And not normally or often in the text, the technical word that's used here is laxity. So these are the two obstacles that are stopping the stability and clarity. But remember that I think, and this is not really mentioned here in the text, is that we need to develop these on the basis of a relaxed mind. Because unfortunately in our modern society, many of us come into this practice from very hectic, stressful backgrounds. Our minds are very agitated, very tense. And when we have to focus on anything in our life, we have to apply a lot of tension to that focus. Otherwise, our mind just goes all over the place. So that's our normal way of focusing, is with tension. And often in these sorts of texts as well, one of the first instructions is to something like firmly focus your attention on your object. And so, of course, we see that and we go, okay, yeah, I know how to do that. And then we clamp down. We clamp down on it. Because that's normally what we do. But then, of course, after a very short time, we get distracted and then we get frustrated and we think, oh, I have to clamp down even harder to stop distraction. And so we end up in this vicious cycle. And then, of course, we get completely frustrated, completely exhausted, and even maybe get headaches from meditating. So we don't want to go that way. And to really highlight that point, again, I'd like to read from Alan Wallace's book here. And this is on page 14. He says the following. And he's using the context here of using the breath, mindfulness of breathing. Thus, our practice of mindfulness of breathing consists of prolonging our awareness of our breath. While this requires an alert mind, such concentration should not be tense, but rather balanced. When we discover that we've become distracted from the meditation object, it may feel naturally to clamp down more forcefully, tightly concentrating the mind. You can see this in the facial expressions of people who try to concentrate in this way. Their lips become pursed, their eyebrows draw together, and their foreheads become furled with wrinkles. They're becoming concentrated, but like orange juice, most of the fluidity is being drained from their minds. If you want to concentrate for a short time and don't mind the side effects of tension and fatigue, you can follow the above strategy. But if you want to follow the path of shamatha, you'll need an alternative. I had to discover this fact through experience. During my first extended shamatha retreat, I was filled with enthusiasm. I wanted to take full advantage of the rare opportunity that was before me, for I was meditating in India under the guidance of the Dalai Lama. This was in the 70s. So in the 70s, you could basically go down and knock on his door and have a chat to him. I mean, I run these introduction courses at Toshita, and I mean, when they first started back in those days, that's what they did. They took each group down to say hello to His Holiness Dalai Lama and talk to him in the early days. You could do that then, but now not possible. I had no financial worries and my material needs were easily met. All I had to do was to put the instructions into practice. I threw myself into this training with all my might. Each morning, I would rise at 3:30. Except once, I slept in until 3:45 and got upset with myself for slacking off. Enthusiastic I was, but so uptight. The Tibetan manuals on shamatha meditation that I had studied over the years stated that the type of attention needed when one began such practice was, quote, highly focused. So I tried as hard as I could to keep my mind from wandering. Within a matter of a few weeks, devoting many hours each day to meditation, I could sustain my attention on my chosen object for up to half an hour. I was elated by making such fast progress. As the weeks went by, however, I found myself becoming more and more fatigued. I was draining myself both physically and mentally, and my joy in the practice was diminishing accordingly, and I felt my attention was not developing any further. What was wrong? I was trying too hard. The cultivation of shamatha involves balancing the mind, and that includes balancing the effort exerted in the practice with relaxation. I think this points to a cultural difference between traditional Tibetans living in the highlands of Tibet and modern people living fast-paced lives, their senses constantly bombarded by telephones, email, the media, and noise. Years of such existence condition the nervous system and mind in ways that might have been considered torture in rural Tibet. One traditional Tibetan doctor whom I know once commented on people living in the West. So now he's quoting the Tibetan doctor who says, "From the perspective of Tibetan medicine, you are all suffering from nervous disorders. But given how ill you are coping remarkably well." Whether we dwell in Boston, Buenos Aires, Berlin, or Beijing, our minds are conditioned to be more high-strung and engaged in compulsive thinking than the minds of Tibetan nomads and farmers living a century ago. So when Tibetan meditation manuals advise beginners to focus their attention firmly, the instructions are aimed at a very different reader than the average city dweller in the 21st century. Before we can develop attentional stability, we first need to learn to relax. So I think that's a very important point. And I know from personal experience and talking to many people that this is one of the main problems that people face when they begin meditation. Their minds are chaotic, and so they clamp down on their meditation object. They get frustrated, they get tired, they even get headaches, and they say, "I can't meditate." So the first thing we need to do is to learn to relax, 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 relax the body, relax the mind. Okay, then it says here, two things, if we continue on in that paragraph, two things are needed for this. That is, two things are needed to develop stability and clarity. One, a technique in which your attention is not distracted from whatever it had as its original object of meditation. And two, an accurate awareness of whether you are distracted and whether you are becoming distracted. The former is mindfulness, the latter is vigilance. So often vigilance here is sometimes translated as introspection. So what is mindfulness? In regard to a familiar object, your mind is not forgetful and operates without distraction. So this is what mindfulness is. It's simply the ability to hold an object, to remember the object without becoming distracted. And then, of course, vigilance or introspection is like quality control. How is mindfulness going? Are we still on the object, or is the mind starting to become agitated, distracted, or dull? So these are the two main tools we use in shamatha practice, and this is symbolized on your chart here, down the shamatha chart. Down the bottom, you see the meditator with, in the left hand, a rope, in the right hand, a hook. So the rope is the rope of mindfulness. It's, we are tying our mind to the object with the rope of mindfulness. And then the hook of introspection is to notice if we're becoming dull or distracted and then hook the mind back. So we're going to go through this chart very shortly. But before we do that, one or two more things. So if we go over onto the top of page 36. So, of course, we just talked about now relating to the question there is about we need that balance between dullness and distraction. So we need to have that balancing act of fine-tuning the mind, which is not so easy to accomplish. Then it talks here about length of sessions. It says here, on this matter, all earlier gurus of the various Tibetan lineages say that you have to do numerous short sessions. So this is saying that the key here is quality over quantity. Because it says, if you have great forgetfulness ensuing from distraction, as well as vigilance so weak that it does not quickly recognize laxity and excitement, then your session must be short. If it is hard for you to forget the object and you can quickly notice laxity and excitement, it does not matter if the session is a little long. So here again, the key is quality over quantity. How long to meditate as a beginner? There is no fixed amount recommended. It depends on us, on our ability. But as a ballpark figure for many beginners, 20-25 minutes can be a good number, but we have to see from our own experience. Some of us, maybe we need to do a little bit shorter. Some of us can maybe sustain it a little bit longer. But we need to be able to, as the text says here, not meditate too long, where for the latter half of the meditation, we're just falling into dullness and distraction. Because actually we're just habituating ourselves to these faults, which are exactly the ones we're trying to overcome. So, again, quality over quantity. And one way of knowing how long to meditate is our enthusiasm the same at the end as it was the beginning? If our enthusiasm is dropping off, then we're probably not being very mindful or vigilant and we're just getting caught up dullness and distraction. So keep the session short. But as it says here, as our concentration improves, then we should actually extend the length of meditation. But when we extend it, don't double it from 20 to 40 minutes. Usually it's recommended 3 to 5 minutes. And then work with that for some time and then keep going like that. And then it says here in the next section, what to do after you focus on the object of meditation. It says here, it develops as a result of using the 8 antidotes in order to eliminate the 5 faults. So let's have a look at what they are, and that's on your shamatha chart on your second page. There's a table. And up the top, it says shamatha is attained by progressing through the 9 stages, which are the 9 drawings on the other page, relying on the 8 antidotes to abandon the 5 faults. So the first fault of laziness we've already looked at. And the antidote to that, of course, is develop faith in the practice by understanding the benefits of the practice. And then from that, we'll develop aspiration, wanting to do the practice, seeing all these benefits. Then that will lead to us putting this joyous effort into the practice. And that's going to lead to what's called pliancy, or serviceability of body and mind, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later. The second fault, of course, is forgetfulness. This forgetfulness can mean either forgetting the instructions on what to do, but also forgetting the object. So the antidote here is mindfulness. So mindfulness, of course, is not only remembering what to do, the instructions, but remembering the object. So mindfulness here is our ability to remember the object, to hold the object without becoming distracted. Then the next fault is this laxity and excitement, or dullness and distraction. And here the antidote is introspection. So introspection, or here is translated as vigilance in this text, is quality control, is to monitor that mindfulness, is again, how are we going? Are we starting to become dull and distracted or not? So introspection then, or vigilance, will notice that we become dull, when we become dull or distracted. Then the Next fault, the fourth one here, says non-application. So what that means, and these faults and antidotes are mentioned in that section in the text where we just now are on page 36, non-application means that we have noticed that we're becoming dull and distracted, but we don't do anything about it. So that's a fault. That's non-application. So, of course, the antidote is application. So with application, of course, what we mean is that to do something to overcome the dullness and distraction. So, again, generally, with agitation and distraction, our mind tends to be too tight. So then the antidote, of course, as I've mentioned a little bit in some of the meditations, is the first thing is to relax, not to get upset, then release the distraction, and then very gently return to the object. So here again, it's often to do, our mind is too tight, so we need to relax it a little bit. Whereas when our mind is getting very dull, our mind tends to be too loose. So then the antidote to that is to sharpen the focus, to really tighten the focus a little bit on the breath. So again, there's this delicate balance between being too tight and too loose. And then, of course, there are, of course, with in terms of laxity and excitement or dullness and distraction, the best cure, of course, is prevention, you know, is to not allow it to come up in the first place. So there are some preventatives that will help us to stop going there to begin with. And so, of course, one of those we've just seen is keep the sessions short, meditate for short sessions. But, of course, also the posture is important. Because if our posture is such that we're sort of hunched over, then of course we're going to be very dull. And sometimes if we're too erect and too upright, the mind gets a bit agitated. And then of course, with that, the eyes, if the eyes are closed, maybe dullness. If they're too wide open, maybe agitation, distraction. Also, where we meditate is important, the room. If the room is too hot, then dullness. If it's too cold, maybe agitation, distraction. Too much light, agitation, distraction. Too dark, dullness. So we can adjust these things. Of course, also a preventative measure we saw earlier is we need to make sure we get enough sleep. Again, unfortunately, in our modern society, many of us have sleep problems, you know, sleep deprivation. If we have sleep deprivation, we're not going to be able to meditate well. So we need to make sure we get enough sleep. And then, of course, diet is important, as we saw earlier, is that we need to have a healthy diet. And one of the main factors these days for the epidemic of ADHD that seems to be in our modern society is the diet, too much sugar in the diet. So we need to make sure we have this healthy diet. And then, of course, if we meditate after a big meal, that's probably not going to be very conducive. We're just going to go into dullness. So again, not eating too much food and not meditating immediately after big meals. So these are all things that we can, you know, work with at home to at least minimize the conditions for getting into dullness and distraction. But of course, then if we get into dullness and distraction, then to correct that in that way. So then the last fault here is over-application. As a beginner, that's often not such a big problem because often we have to fix it, our mind a lot because it's going to dullness and distraction a lot. But as we progress in the practice, we're going to get to stages where there will be periods where we're really focusing quite well with the mindfulness. And so here the fault is we keep adjusting that focus unnecessarily. So that's over-application. The antidote here is equanimity. And this equanimity here is just basically, equanimity means balance. So here it means just leave the mind as it is because it's already balanced. So again, if it's not broken, don't fix it. So this is one fault that we have to be a little bit more careful about as we progress in the practice, that we start adjusting our mind too much unnecessarily. So these are the five faults and the eight antidotes. Any questions on those? Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit more about that last point? I'm not sure I get that.
The over-application?
Yes.
Yeah. So, again, the challenge in general is to have the balance, to being not too tight, not too relaxed or too loose. And so often we are tuning that balance. And as a beginner, we can even do that on every breath, because the out-breath is a sort of natural time to relax and release tension and distraction. And the in-breath is a natural time to sharpen the focus. So we can even do that balancing act on every breath. But then, of course, if we are getting to the point where our mind is becoming more balanced and we can sustain that balance, then doing this balancing act continuously is a problem. Yeah. So, therefore, this is a little bit over-application. So if we find that we getting to a point where we're in the rhythm and we're holding the object quite well and clearly, then to keep balancing the mind is too much. We just need to stop doing that. That's equanimity.
Can I just offer something from personal experience?
Sure.
I first came across that book, The Attention Revolution, about 3.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of picked it up at random one evening when I was just about falling asleep. And within a page and a half, I was wide awake. and my enthusiasm, I mean, just shot up like that. But over the years, this has to do with that first fault of laziness.
Sure.
You know, I got discouraged. I mean, I kept trying, and a couple times in retreat, I'd do fine, but then in daily life, just nothing happened. Stage one. and I just tend to get depressed. And this has to do with that cognitive fusion. Think of myself as a lazy person.
Yeah.
And then I come to read in this by Geshe Raft and the mind and its functions that laziness is simply a mental factor.
Exactly.
And it has the function of causing the power of enthusiasm to decrease.
Yeah.
It is so important to, when you're beginning to work with these antidotes, faith, aspiration, and effort. Faith is what inspires, if you will, aspiration.
Sure.
And those are what inspire enthusiasm.
Sure.
So for me, and faith doesn't just mean necessarily like faith in the Buddha or the Buddhist teachings. It can be faith that a method like this is possible, that it's possible to concentrate the mind highly and to bring about these results. So for me, I have to keep going back and reading things like this or other books that deal with shamatha meditation over and over to kind of restore my faith, if you will, and then my aspiration, but also including the bodhicitta.
Sure.
That's important for me.
Sure.
All that helps build up the enthusiasm, the energy.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's necessary.
Absolutely. It's a very, very important point. And as you said, from your own experience and also my experience, quite similar, and many people's experiences, is they simply try to do this practice and then they're not really getting very far and then they just sort of give up. And
get excited about it again.
Yeah, and then that's right. So the thing is to... That's why these foundation practices of precious human life and death and you know, where is happiness, is it out there in here? These sorts of reflections can really inspire us to see that these are methods for us to make it not only our life meaningful, but to really overcome our mental afflictions and suffering. And then, as you mentioned, what can be helpful on top of that is to expand our motivation outside the skin of our body. That if we keep that motivation within ourselves, again, we're going to probably get into cognitive fusion and so forth. Whereas if we can expand it out that I'm not only doing this practice because I'm going to get a lot of benefit myself, but I'm doing this practice so that I can really help others much more. So if we can really keep this in mind, then we can really overcome the laziness.
That's another part of the thing about mindfulness as being, like you're saying, just remembering that. But mindfulness also in the practice of meditation, sometimes, at least in the beginning, I have to keep reminding myself not just about the object, but what the instructions are, what I sat down to do.
Exactly. I mean, that's in this explanation here about forgetfulness. Often in the explanation there, it more is pointing at the instructions, forgetting the instructions. Yes.
Sharing experience, I feel like I should point this out, but I want to hear your comment. In terms of the way the Bodhisattva, Shantideva, in terms of something short that captures all of this and motivation and every single thing, I mean, it leaves me with incredible motivation. And again, not very long. I'm just saying, I'm coming back to this hard that some of the details, when I need to recapture it, this is what it will, I know it.
Yeah. And I think, again, one of the key things that I see is really to, if we include others in our motivation, that's going to sustain much more. Like often, you know, if there's something difficult and it's only to do with ourself, then we can just easily, we just say, oh, no, forget about that. Right. But if we are doing that for the sake of others and it's difficult, then we're more likely to persevere because others are counting on us. So let's really keep going. And
he doesn't let you forget that for a second. It's all about other people. But again, he's not hitting you over the head.
No.
You read it and you're like, you're right, I want to do that too.
Yeah. I mean, we know that in our life that often if there's some difficulty and it's only related to ourselves, then often we just go, oh, I forget about that. But if other people are counting on us to do something and it's difficult, we'll more likely persevere to be able to then help them. So this, I think, can also be helpful here with laziness.
Can you talk about symptoms that you mentioned? It's like self-defeating to try and get the symptom, like, oh, my breath is going away. I'll pay attention to my breath and it comes back. You know, but she mentioned, like, your breath going away or your body going away. Are there other symptoms that kind of come out of this? I feel like in meditation there's almost like symptoms that fall out.
I'm not sure the question. So
the question is if you could comment on any other symptoms besides...
Symptoms, you mean like what will arise?
Side effects. I guess it's almost like side effects or things that arise. You know you're getting a certain distance because you've had this event.
Oh, yeah, that's the next topic. We're going to talk about these 9 steps.
Okay.
And what are the things we can notice at each one of these stages. And then we're going to talk at the end what are the sorts of experiences that we will have in Shamatha. So that all of this is coming. It's coming right now, in fact.
I have a question about objects.
And
approaching the object. So focusing on the breath is very challenging for me, but I think important. And I can't do it with good quality for very long. And so what I like to do is set a timer.
Yeah.
And visualizing is really easy and joyful for me. And so like doing 15 minutes on the breath and then switching over to visualization works well. Does that seem...
Right. I mean, I'm not sure what you're doing in the visualization, whether you're just using a mental image as an object or you're doing some sort of other practice. Mm-hmm. But, of course, again, quality over quantity. And I think, again, as you mentioned, it's very good to set the timer. Because we already mentioned this in the joyous effort, joyous perseverance, that we need to have this steadfastness, that we need to complete the things that we begin. This is very important. So if we don't set a timer and things are going difficult, we'll go, oh, yeah, that must be 15 minutes. I'll just stop now. So we don't want to do that, because then we're just going to get in the habit of whenever things get a bit difficult, we're going to give up. So that's one thing. But the other point that related to that is with the timer is... if we set the timer and it goes off and things are going very well, then often the temptation is, oh, it's going really well, so I'll just keep going. Mm-hmm. And so what do? We keep going till when? Till when do we keep going? Till it starts to go bad. That's when we stop. And the thing we remember most about meditation is how it ended. And so if we're always ending in dullness and distraction, we're going to associate meditation with these sorts of experiences, and then we're going to look at the cushion the next day and go, oh, I don't want to meditate. I have bad experience. even though most of the previous day was quite focused, the last 2 or 3 minutes wasn't. That's what we remember. So if we set the timer and then the timer goes off and we're in the middle of a focused period, that's what we remember. We'll be enthusiastic. We'll want to meditate again. I mean, even some traditions go to the point of saying, when things start to go well, stop. So what we can do, of course, is if we have a certain amount of time and we can sustain that quite well, then we can sort of test the water and say, okay, today I'm going to go a little bit longer and see how it goes and whether I'm really up to increasing the time or not. That we can do. And then there was another part of your question.
No, that was it.
Oh, okay.
Is that switching objects?
Right. Oh, so yeah. So what we can do, of course, is that in a like a morning practice, I think if we just do shamatha and that's all, that's going to be a little bit unbalanced. So I think it's good to maybe some mornings we just do that, but other mornings maybe we start with some shamatha to really calm the mind. And then the second half of the meditation, we move into and do some other sorts of meditation, particularly things like loving kindness and compassion and, you know, this bodhicitta and so forth, that to follow that up. So we can start with the shamatha to really calm, clear mind. And then the second part, we can do some other, maybe vipassana or loving kindness or something. So that of course, is fine.
Just one point of confusion. If we're going with the mind as our focal, these experiences that we've been having here where we focus on the thoughts arising and falling, focus and label, or rest and awareness, those are all to do with the mind, right? We're not switching.
Correct.
Okay, and what about holding the Buddha? Is that...
The mental image of a Buddha?
Yes.
Yeah, then we just...
Okay.
Then we just hold the mental image of the Buddha the whole session.
But it's all still within the same sphere. We're not...
I mean, of course, even if we begin by having a visual object or the sensations of the breath, these are physical objects.
Mm-hmm.
As we really progress, and I mean, I'm talking about quite substantially, our sense faculties will shut down. So if we began with a sensory object, we'll have to switch to a mental object. But fortunately, if we're using the breath, that happens automatically. If at some point, due to our improved focus, we'll start to have this, what's called acquired sign, this mental image that is related to the breath. It's not something we need to generate. It happens spontaneously. Then when that arises, we switch to that and we use that for the rest of the way. So that is still mindfulness of breathing, but now we're using a mental image related to the breath and not the physical sensations of the breath anymore. Okay. Then if we move on in the text, the next outline here, it says, the stages in which the mental states are thereby developed. So that is the bottom of page 36. So let's have a look now at these 9 levels. See, so these 9 that you are mentioned correspond to this diagram here. So let's briefly have a look at this diagram. So down the bottom, we see the meditator. And so remember the 2 tools. In the left hand is the rope of mindfulness. In the right hand, the hook of introspection or vigilance. The elephant is the mind. The fact that it is black is symbolizing dullness or laxity. The monkey is conceptual or discursive thought in general. The fact that it is black is symbolizing this excitement. So here at the first stage, which is called setting the mind, we see that the elephant and monkey are running wildly ahead of us. Meaning that at the first stage of practice, setting the mind, what we notice is that our mind is completely out of control. That we, for example, try to focus on the breath, and usually after about 3 or 4 seconds, we're completely distracted. And then often minutes later, we realize, hang on, I'm supposed to be on the breath. And then we come back to the breath again. And then a few seconds later, we're gone again. And so at the first stage, we are most of the time, by far, most of the time distracted. We are hardly on the meditation object. And often what people's experiences here are is that they go into this practice thinking, you know, I think I should be able to focus on the breath okay. Yeah, I might get a bit dull and distracted, but I think I can do that okay. And then, of course, when this happens and they get distracted after a few seconds and they keep that keeps happening, then they come to the conclusion, well, I just can't meditate, you know. In fact, it's worse than that, because since I've started to meditate, my mind has got worse. And then often what people do is then if they're in a group, they open their eyes and look around, everyone's super still. In fact, I'm the only one who can't meditate. And so they beat themselves up, because obviously everyone else is meditating because they're all very still. If this is your experience, then you can meditate and you've made it to step number one. Because step number one is really about coming to realize and see how out of control our mind really is. And our mind is not getting worse. It's just for the very first time in our life, we're seeing how dysfunctional our mind really is. Because previously, we're always outward and distracted and we don't really notice how out of control our mind really is. It's only when we have to focus on a single object that we can see how dysfunctional our mind really is. So this is usually the first sign of progress, is to see how crazy our mind is, how out of control it is. So all we need to do again is very patiently notice dullness and distraction and keep coming back, keep coming back, keep coming back. And if we do that, we will get to the second stage of practice here around the corner. And around the corner here, each of these roads are what's called these six powers. The first road is the power of hearing. So we hear instructions about the practice, and due to that power of hearing instructions, we can begin the practice and get to step number one. The second stage, second road, is the power of contemplation or reflection. So we're then now starting to reflect and contemplate more about the practice, and through that, we can start to progress a little bit in the practice. And so step two here, which is called in this translation continuous setting, the elephant and monkey are not running so wildly anymore, and they have a little bit of white on the top of their head. That white is symbolizing these factors of stability and clarity. So by the second stage of practice, we are starting to notice that there will be periods in our meditation where our mind now starts to settle down a bit to be a bit more stable and clear. But even at the second stage here, we're often distracted, and when we're distracted, we're still often distracted for long periods of time. So even at the second stage of practice, we tend to be more distracted than we are on the object. But then, of course, if we continue to develop our mindfulness, and so the third road is the road of mindfulness, so by the third stage, our mindfulness now is getting quite strong or quite good. So the third stage here is called resetting. And so here with resetting, we now see that the rope of mindfulness is now tied to the elephant of the mind. So again, symbolizing that mindfulness now is getting a lot better. And the elephant now has its head turning backwards, meaning now, when we get distracted, we quickly notice that we're distracted and quickly return to the object. So that is symbolized by the elephant turning the head backwards, coming back to the object quickly. Now, of course, we see the rabbit has come into the picture on the back of the elephant. The rabbit is symbolizing what's called subtle dullness or subtle laxity. By the third stage, now we can hold the object quite well. Maybe, you know, the first stage, a couple of seconds. Second stage, maybe up to a minute or two. By the third stage, then we can hold the object maybe 5 or 10 minutes before we become distracted. And now when we become distracted, we quickly notice it and quickly come back. So now by the third stage, our practice seems to be really moving along quite well. So our stability is getting quite good. But what is very much lacking is the quality of our attention. And so now we need to start to notice that our this what's called subtle dullness or laxity, that we're not focusing very clearly on the object. Of course, that was the case before, but stage one and two, we had much heavier problems to worry about than a little bit of subtle dullness. So by the third stage now, we're probably extending our time we can meditate a lot more than maybe 20 minutes. Then if we continue on, we'll get to the fourth stage here called close setting. Close setting, by the fourth stage, our mindfulness is really getting very good now, meaning we can hold the object the entire session without ever completely losing it. But still, we have a lot of work to do on the quality of our attention. So you may have noticed already that you can sort of focus on the breath and think about breakfast at the same time. So that, of course, is a lot of background noise. So here at stage four, there's still a lot of background noise. So we are trying to improve the quality of our attention. So then if we go around the corner to stage five and six, this is the road of introspection or vigilance. Now it's a lot to do with quality control, fine-tuning our focus. So this is where we see the hook of introspection is more prominent, in that we are now really fine-tuning our attention. If we're starting to get a little bit dull, we're sharpening a bit. If our mind is becoming a little bit agitated, we're relaxing. So a lot of fine-tuning here, so that when we get to the end of stage six and around to seven, we see now that the monkey, the rabbit is gone. We're saying goodbye to the monkey. The elephant hardly has any black left on the body, which means by stage seven, we can now really, with just a little bit of effort at the beginning, we can easily dispel any sort of subtle dullness or laxity and really have very good focus. And then by stage eight here, all the black is gone, the monkey is gone. Now all we need to do is put a little bit of effort at the beginning to start the meditation, and then we can flawlessly meditate without any hint of subtle dullness or laxity for an extended period of time. Stage nine, where we see the meditator in the cave with the elephant of the mind, now everything becomes spontaneous and effortless. And we can meditate spontaneously, effortlessly, without any hint of subtle dullness or subtle agitation for at least 4 hours. But we still haven't achieved shamatha. Shamatha is now the middle at the top diagram, where we see the meditator sitting on the back of the elephant of the mind and flying through the sky. So these two, the fact that the person is flying through the sky here is symbolizing what's called this physical pliancy or serviceability of the body. And the meditator on the back of the elephant of the mind is pliancy of the mind, serviceability of the mind. We can turn our attention of our mind to whatever we want without any resistance. So let's have a look at what really this transition is from stage nine to shamatha in terms of this pliancy or serviceability of body and mind. And to describe this transition, I'd like to read from Alan Wallace's book here again, Attention Revolution, on page 155. He says, following the realization of the ninth stage of attentional balance, after months or years of continuous practice, you are primed to achieve shamatha. The nine preceding stages entail many incremental changes, but the actual accomplishment of shamatha involves a radical transition in your body and mind. You will be like a butterfly emerging from its cocoon. This shift is characterized by specific experiences that take place within a discrete, relatively brief period of time. According to accounts from the Indo-Tibetan tradition of Buddhism, The first sign of the achievement of shamatha is the experience of a sense of heaviness and numbness on the top of the head. This allegedly happens to anyone who experiences this transition, regardless of the specific method followed. It is said to feel as if a palm were being placed on the top of your head. It is not unpleasant or harmful, just unusual. Something remarkable must be taking place in the cortical region of your brain at this point. But so far, no one has monitored the brain correlates of this shift using magnetic resonance imaging or an electroencephalograph. This physical sensation on the top of the head is symptomatic of a shift in your nervous system or network of vital energies that is correlated with gaining freedom from mental dysfunction, a general state of mental imbalance characterized by stiffness, rigidity, and unwieldiness. Consequently, you achieve a state of mental pliancy in which your mind is fit and supple like never before. From a contemplative perspective, when the mind is dysfunctional or prone to laxity and excitation, it is hard to generate enthusiasm for healing the afflictions of your mind or for devoting yourself to virtuous mental activity. Once you are free of such mental dysfunction, you can focus your mind without resistance on any meaningful object or task, and such a mind is now set to be fit or serviceable. This is the key to achieving optimal mental performance. So again, that's symbolized by the person sitting on the back of the elephant of the mind. We can now direct our mind to whatever we want without any resistance whatsoever. Following this sense of pressure on the top of your head, you experience the movement of vital energies moving in your body. And when they have coursed everywhere throughout your body, you feel as if you are filled with the power of this dynamic energy. You are now freed of physical dysfunction, so your body feels buoyant and light like never before. And that's symbolized by the person flying through the sky. Both your body and mind are now imbued with an exceptional degree of pliancy, which makes them remarkably fit for engaging in all kinds of mental training and other meaningful activities. When physical pliancy initially arises, the vital energies catalyze an extraordinary sense of physical bliss, which then triggers an equally exceptional experience of mental bliss. This rush of physical and mental rapture is transient, which is a good thing, for it so captivates the attention that you can do little else except enjoy it. Gradually it subsides, and you are freed from the turbulence caused by this intense joy. Your attention settles down in perfect stability and clarity. You have now achieved shamatha.
What page is that?
155. Sounds good, huh? There's a few more things to talk about there, but I'll do that in the beginning of the afternoon session. So now, a couple of discussion questions before we go for lunch. We talked about, in this practice, it's effectively about overcoming the five faults using the eight antidotes. So the question is here, discuss practical ways of using these eight antidotes to overcome the five faults. So discuss practical ways to use the eight antidotes to overcome the five faults. And the second question is just related to what we've just looked at here, these nine stages. And what you'll notice on the diagram here is lots of numbers. So they they're described on the second page of your handout. So I think the second question might be good is just to review these nine stages. And you can use some of that information to help you to review them.
What are the flames?
Excitement? Yeah, so the flames is number five. So it says here, from here until the seventh stage, the flame progressively decreases in size until it is absent. This difference denotes the measure of the strength of effort required during mindfulness and introspection. It means that the flame is very big at the beginning because we need a lot of effort to sustain mindfulness and introspection. But as they improve, we see that actually it becomes really effortless to have mindfulness and introspection.
So it's not excitement?
No. So again, you can look at this chart. So the second question again is just to review the nine stages using these numbers. There's a couple of things on the chart I haven't discussed yet, which I'll finish off this afternoon, particularly the last diagram in the top right-hand corner. That's this afternoon. The last question then goes back to yesterday afternoon topic, the six perfections. In what way are each of the six perfections important? In what way are each of the six perfections important? So that means you can look at each of the six perfections and see how they're important in our path to enlightenment.
So you mean with respect to the Shalatha?
We're talking now the path to enlightenment. In what way are each of the six perfections important on our path to enlightenment? So that's got nothing to do... Well, I mean, the fifth perfection is shamatha, but... Yeah.
Gotcha.
The big picture, yeah. Okay, so let's break for lunch. Come back at 3:30. A few more things to talk about the shamatha practice, and then we'll start to move into the vipassana practice this afternoon later.